Of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for Monday, February 28, 2005, and also open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5527. Let me just share with you that Senator Devlin is delayed, but he will be arriving as soon as possible. We are happy to see several people with us this morning to help us with this presentation on the Student Assistance Commission. We have Margie Lowe, Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, Brian Clem, Chair of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. We'll be hearing from Vicki Merkel, Grants and Scholarships Program Director for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And then we have Tim Nesbitt, co-chair of the Access and Affordability Working Group of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education. And we're very pleased to welcome our own Steve Bender back from the Legislative Fiscal Office. With that said, and Mr. Bender, do you have any opening comments or any guidance for the committee?
No, Madam Chair, this begins 2 days that you have scheduled for the Phase 1 hearing portion for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So they will be presenting, making their presentation to you today and tomorrow.
Thank you very much. And please proceed. Who's going first?
I'm just going to introduce the other commissioners.
Very good.
For the record, my name is Brian Clem. I'm the chair of the Student Assistance Commission. And maybe they could stand up. I think I have almost all of them here but one.
Great.
Cap Sharpless, he's from Coos Bay, and he's a retired high school counselor. Does a lot of work with our Aspire program and private scholarships. Terry Edvilson from LeGrand, and I like to call him our high-paid consultant that we use for free to help guide and provide governance. And he retired out of the state system. Jesse Lorkey, he's a student at Portland State. Jen Baldwin, and she's a student at Portland State. Jesse's in political science, and Jen's in history. And Bob Wheel, and he's from the Portland area, retired out of Nordstrom's a while ago. But he's also, he likes to remind us that he audits classes at PSU to check on the state of higher ed, and he's done, I think, a couple hundred audit courses by now, so he's very active. And then Dean Wendell, our other commissioner, I think he'll join us tomorrow, and he's from Grants Pass and is a career banker down in Southern Oregon.
Mr. Clem, I also see that you have several students here. Can you tell us about them and where they're from?
I can only speculate because I don't know them all, but I'm guessing that we've got students from all sectors. That would be the community colleges, OUS, and independent sector, because our grant goes to all those sectors and they're all avidly interested in its funding level. So if anybody else is from another sector that I'm unaware of exists, then I don't know.
Well, welcome. We're very pleased, always very pleased to see students here, and we invite you to share your thoughts with us, with your legislators. And again, it's just a pleasure that you're all with us this morning. And to the students who chose Portland State, you chose well. Please continue.
The only other thing I just wanted to briefly touch on before Margie begins our presentation, the commission, as some of you know that I visited with in the last week, provides oversight and some policy making that's been delegated by the legislature to the commission, and then a general guidance to the agency on questions that come up throughout the biennium when the legislature's not in session. And this last two-year period, we went through an inordinate amount of effort, I think, to review our activities. We did public hearings all around the state on two different topics. One was our budget, and the other was on the a budget note report that we'll cover in the program about the relative flatness or not of our opportunity grant. But we hit, I think, 8 cities in total all over Oregon. There was at least one commissioner, if not two, present at all of those public hearings. Received a lot of input both about the budget and the way we're structured and the level of funding and about the grant itself. We had a work group that we convened. I believe there's a letter on your desk that's addressed to Teresa McHugh, and it's from former State Senator Cliff Trow. that work group took a look at two topics. One had to do with our student loan program, and the results of that will be covered in the slideshow presentation. And the other was about the other functions of the agency and the activities that we're engaged in. And what you'll notice on the second page is a very long list of people who participated in that, covering private foundations and most of the various institutions that you could imagine in higher education. And Senator Tro is out of town this week, and so that's why he's unable to be here to share his work, but he would be happy, I'm sure, to meet with you privately if you would like later to entertain questions. They had a long series of meetings during the summer to discuss the agency and review its activities and issue in the end some conclusions for the governor's office about the agency, and I think those would be of some use to you as well. Then the last piece, when Tim Nesbitt is here, the Oregon State Board of Higher Ed, as you know, took several of their board members and assigned them each committees and brought in community members to review various pieces of higher ed. They ended up looking at the question of access for students to be able to attend college. So in the end, we got another outside look at the Oregon Opportunity Grant, a review by a large number of citizens, and they have their conclusions, which he'll share as well. So we've been scrutinizing ourselves relatively heavily over the last 2 years and look forward to sharing all that information with you and answering questions you have. And then our lucky find here has been Margie Lau, our executive director, that I want to introduce to you. And as we move into this next biennium, Margie's been able to take a job rotation for 1 year to work with the agency. She was of incredible assistance as we exited the student loan program. Really would not have been able to do it successfully without her. And has been fortunate enough to give us of her evenings, weekends, and all her free time. For a while there, she did both her jobs, and now we're able to have her full time, which is about 80 hours a week, I think, but we only pay her for 40. So with that, I'd like to turn things over to her.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. As Brian said, I'm the interim executive director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I've had a chance to work with some of you in my prior role at the Department of Human Services. Up until last August, I, like many of the folks here in the room, simply was a person who was aware of the Student Assistance Commission more from a consumer perspective. I happen to have two daughters who are college students, and so I was aware of their programs and helped fill out scholarship application forms. But I got a call from the Department of Administrative Services asking me, while I was dropping my daughter off at college, if I would be available to help out. So fortunately, my bosses at DHS were flexible and allowed me this opportunity. And so I'm glad to be here, and hopefully I can respond to your questions and concerns as we go along.
I do apologize for mispronouncing your last name.
Oh, no problem. A common... that would be the English pronunciation. The mission of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is to assist Oregon students and their families in helping those students attain a post-secondary education, and also to enhance the value, integrity, and diversity of Oregon's college programs. We do this through a variety of programs and have a variety of goals to help us do that. In order to increase the college attendance and completion in Oregon, we do that by providing information, mentoring, and support to college-bound students. Our primary vehicle for doing this is our Aspire program. This is a program that's funded entirely with grant funds. We also do that through a variety of pieces of literature that's disseminated through high schools and through our websites available to students in a variety of different forms. We also help Oregon's lowest income families and students by offering them the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We hope to be able to do that in the future for all eligible students who meet the financial criteria. We also help students that go to school by increasing the grant dollars that are awarded for students. This is a very important function that we do. Again, a number of folks across the state recognize how important post-secondary education is and would like to be able to use their personal resources to help students be able to go to school. We hopefully provide a very smooth resource to help students do that in a very efficient way. And we also do that by increasing the number of college scholarships funded through private sources, those donors that I mentioned earlier. The other function that's within the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is the Office of Degree Authorization. This program reports directly to the commission, and it oversees the authorization of degree-granting functions in any institution in Oregon that's not privately accredited. It also screens any programs or issues related to diploma mills. To share with the committee a little bit of a history lesson about the origins of the Student Assistance Commission, back in 1955, then-Senator Mark Hatfield proposed a piece of legislation that would allow a scholarship program for students who wanted to attend Oregon's public and private schools. That bill didn't pass in that session, but in 1958, a citizen discovered a bill that had been on the books for a long time, since 1985, that established a student aid program that allowed legislators and judges to each award a scholarship to an Oregon, to what was in those days Oregon State's predecessor, the Oregon Agricultural College. This created quite a crisis, as I understand, for state government because it was in between legislative sessions and there was not any appropriation to fund this particular function. But the various entities who could award these went ahead and did it, and it then created a real fiscal issue for the Oregon Agricultural College. So in 1959, the new governor, Senator Hatfield, then Governor Hatfield, actually created a bipartisan bill that created the State Scholarship Commission and actually funded those programs. Over the years, there were a number of changes that were made to the State Scholarship Commission, which was its first name. It then became the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. In 1967, we began the student loan program. And over the years, that program grew substantially. In the early 1990s, there were pieces of federal legislation that were passed that changed how the program worked. Prior to that, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission was the loan guarantee agency for all student loans in Oregon. That federal legislation that passed in the early 90s allowed schools to become a part of what was the direct student loan program. About three-quarters of Oregon's student loan volume shifted to that direct student loan program, which then decreased the volume of transactions that were being taken care of by the Student Assistance Commission. At the same time, the federal government was also reducing the reimbursement that they were paying to its guarantee agencies to perform those functions. The combination of those various market factors really created a long-term decline in revenues that were going to be available to support the program, and that really came to a very critical stage during the previous 12 months. The program was in a very fragile situation, and because of that, the staff and the commission asked for a special study to be done of the overall loan program function and its resources. That study resulted in the naming of the Oregon Futures Work Group that culminated in a piece of the document that you have on your table, which basically said that Oregon should exit the student loan program. So while we were doing that, you know, there were a number of steps that had to take place in order to carry that out. It ultimately resulted in the Educational Credit Management Corporation being named as Oregon's guarantee agency. Their assumption of those functions took place January 1st of this year, and they have located in the very same office building as what we're in Eugene, and in fact hired eight of the staff who had previously been employees of OSAC. Throughout all of this transition, there were a number of staffing changes that also occurred, and this slide just briefly summarizes those. You know, Shelley Turner, a longtime OSAC loan program employee, came on to help the commission work through all of the issues with the federal government and the new guarantee agency. She has been an absolute gem in terms of the resource to help oversee that because of her long history and knowledge about the program. In addition to that, we had a number of employees who we had to find ways in which to move off of our payroll. As I mentioned, some of them found jobs with ECMC, the new guarantee agency, but many of the rest of those employees found employment either through their own initiative or through an outplacement type of service that we did in conjunction with the Service Employees International Union. As you can see, our staff, since its peak a couple of years ago at 95, has declined considerably to today's present employment of 23 employees. As I mentioned, the Futures Work Group, as it went through its deliberations, decided that the loan program was not viable and that Oregon would need to consider other alternatives, which culminated in ECMC picking up the new function. They also felt very strongly that OSAC provides vital services focused on serving students, that its remaining functions were very important, and that its location was also important, not in terms of its physical location, but more in terms of its autonomy in the post-secondary environment. We serve all three of the post-secondary sectors, the two-year community college students, the four-year public university students, and the four-year independent colleges. They also saw the growing need in Oregon as well as across the country for the Opportunity Grant Program to be expanded in conjunction as well with the Aspire and Scholarship Services. The work group was well aware and was coordinating through the commission with the OUS, or the Oregon University Systems Access and Affordability Work Group, the issues of the growing number of students who were having difficulty being able to afford attending Oregon's public universities and community colleges. They felt it was important for the agency to have an expansion role. I think some of you may be aware that there was some consideration of changing the nature of the functions, and they steered away from that and said that the Oregon Student Assistance Commission was already the agency charged by statute and by longstanding effective and efficient services to carry out those functions. In conjunction with their last recommendation, this is one that we've not yet had a chance to move to, but will be doing so in the next 30 days, and that is to establish an ad hoc policy advisory board to assist and inform the commission to coordinate these issues across those three post-secondary education sectors.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. In relationship to scholarship programs, I heard a little mention on that. I'm not as familiar with scholarships today as I was a few years ago, but at that time, there were, every year, always scholarships went begging for students. Unused scholarships available. Do you do anything? Have you corrected that problem in Oregon? Do you do anything with matching up students with outstanding scholarships?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, thank you for asking that question. Today and tomorrow are two of our most peak work days of the entire academic year. Tomorrow is the scholarship deadline date, so if any of you have post-secondary students or high school seniors, I'd encourage you to urge them to finish their application if that's the case. We have over 9,000 applications that come in the door for students interested in the 320 scholarships that we administer. To my knowledge, none of those go without a claimant for them, and in many of them, we have literally thousands of applications for those scholarships. We really have done a lot in order to increase accessibility to that, and Vicki will talk about that in much greater detail. But we have a single application that students can fill out for all 320 scholarships Some of them require some particular additions or augmentations in order to meet the donor's requirements. But speaking as one of those parents of a student that did a lot of scholarship work in her senior year, the OSAC application, its electronic form, was by far and away the easiest form that I filled out as I helped her wind her way through over 30 different scholarships. It's really a very efficient one. If there's scholarships that go wanting, I would assume that those are ones that we've not had a chance to reach out to the donor organization to link into our common application form. But if there are schools there, we'd like to do that.
May I suggest that would certainly be worthwhile to reach out to them?
We would be glad to do that. So, if Representative Jensen, you know of any particular ones you'd like to?
Like I said, it's been a number of years since I was active in higher education. So.
Okay. To move on to the organization chart, the this is the organization chart as the agency stood at the end of last legislative session. And here it's not real obvious, but on this next slide it will be more apparent which parts of the agency were tied to the loan program activity. The boxes on the overhead projection that have the red type in them are the ones that have all lost staff because of the closure of the student loan program. The most direct services related to the loan program were the Guarantee Services Division, the Default Prevention and Claims Division, and the Collections Division. As you can see, there were large numbers of staff in each one of those areas. In addition to that, three positions were eliminated in the Information Technology Division, leaving us with three remaining positions. The deputy position was eliminated. Two public information positions were eliminated. Our personnel officer position was eliminated. We will now be contracting with the Department of Administrative Services for those functions. And the Office of Degree Authorization also lost a position.
May I clarify, did you say that the public information function will be picked up by the Department of Administrative Services?
Madam Chair, no, the human resources, the personnel-related functions will be picked up by the Department of Administrative Services. The public information functions will just be a part of what every employee needs to consider as they do their job. It will not be a separate identified function. In the Grants and Scholarships Division, there are two additional positions there, and those are related to the Aspire program and its future. As you can see, there are four positions that are related to kind of the common administrative functions, the executive director position, a support person to support all of the central functions, and two fiscal positions. The next chart just summarizes the staff that were lost as we went through the reductions. And the following chart gives you kind of a bird's eye view of that. And then the one immediately below that gives you more detail of what the remaining positions and their functions are. This is a very much more streamlined and efficient organization. The exit of the loan program is still going on as we speak, and so not all of those functions have been ones that we can consider stop doing altogether, because we're still working on migrating the information systems databases over to the new organization and dealing with the closeout of the federal audits related to this. But once those are gone, these are the staff that will be critical to maintain for the next two-year period. There are three positions. We actually have approval for 26 positions. Three of those positions are presently vacant, and that's because of revenue shortfalls. At this point, I'd like to...
Senator Nelson has a question.
Because, I mean, obviously there was a problem there. What was the problem? I mean, what was the process you went through to make this a very significant change?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. The student loan program, which was the, where the majority of the employees in the agency worked prior to December 31st of this past year, was a program that we administered under the, basically in partnership with the federal government, the U.S. Department of Education. Where Oregon acted as the loan guarantee agency for student loans for institutions who wanted us to do that here in Oregon. The changes in the federal legislation throughout the 90s reduced the number of institutions to whom we provided those services. Many of the Oregon institutions chose to do the direct student loan program, which means that they deal one-on-one with the U.S. Department of Education themselves. And in conjunction with that, the federal government was also changing the reimbursement methodology that they were paying all of the guarantee agencies across the United States in which to perform those functions. The combination of the reduced reimbursement along with the reduced new loan volume really changed the market dynamics. The business was just going away, and the remaining business that we had was not paying as well as what it had been in the past. The agency had the advantage of having large ending balance reserves built up in the program by which they could continue to operate the program for a number of years, but that ending balance was dwindling steadily and costs were increasing, particularly in the information technology area. So nationally there is a process going on for more and more consolidation. And talking with the folks at the U.S. Department of Education, their sense and their direction overall is to go to fewer and larger guarantee agencies. And in fact, we've even heard them refer to things in terms of, you know, in the next 10 years, maybe there only being 5 guarantee agencies for the entire country, as opposed to right now there's 34. So it's a kind of a market consolidation process.
Oh, it appears that prior structure, organizational structure, didn't react to the changes, didn't have a plan of any sort to change, and just kept on going. So what you're telling us that you now have a business plan of some sort, or you have another plan, what are you doing to make sure that this is this huge ongoing change? What are you doing now? I mean, I guess you are doing something. You've done pretty significant things, but kind of reinforce that if you could, please.
Madam Chair, if I might, who is our chair at the moment? I guess it is. Senator Nelson, if I could speak to that. I've been the chair of the commission for about 2.5 years now. And at the time, we got right around the end of our last Ways and Means presentation 2 years ago. The exec director at that time sort of said, we've got this big problem. And the commission knew that we were trying to gain market share back. But we would get one school here, lose another one there. Someone would switch to a different client. They might switch to a different system. And as the feds changed the way we made money, and this was a non-taxpayer supported activity, if you didn't have clients, you didn't have any revenue. And so as we saw that we were losing clients to other systems, other programs, the exec director said, well, you're going to have to do something drastic. And his solutions, were going to be in a way that kept us in the loan business, I think. The commission decided we didn't want to be in the loan business anymore. There was no way we could assure you protection of the general fund in any safe measure if we had stayed in this business. And we were potentially, if we hadn't gotten out of it when we did incorrectly, we were on the hook for $7 million even as recently as last November. And so the commission really took very decisive action. I asked the exec director to step down. I hired somebody else to take his place. We initiated the student loan work group that said we need to get out of this, period. And that's how we're protecting ourselves in the future, is we are completely out of the business entirely. And it's a business that the students have many other alternatives. And so what had happened was you had a government agency running a private business, basically, and it didn't need to anymore. There were many other competitors who were more than happy to come and do these things. And some of our clients had already moved to them and found, you know, their services and expertise, I guess, better suited to their campuses. So we didn't want to find a way to limp along and sort of barely stay in business, even though it meant laying off many people. And I probably spent 150 of my own personal hours dealing with this issue over the last year to try and get us out of this as smoothly as possible with as minimal impact to our employees. But bottom line is, this is not a business that our state government should be in anymore. And that's why you're looking at the declines. And I can guarantee at this point we're protected from it because we've gotten our sign-offs from the federal government, ECMC, on our various liabilities and revenue projections as of January 1.
Mr. Bender, you've worked with this agency as it has worked its way through the organizational structural changes. Do you wish to comment on the process that they have been working through and where we are now?
Sure, Madam Chair. I would agree with Mr. Clem that there was general understanding that there was a problem with the loan program, and indeed the legislature had supported efforts in prior biennia to allow the agency to increase its loan volume, or to assist the agency in increasing its loan volume, because we were aware that they were facing increasing competition and that they needed to increase loan volume in order to maintain their participation in that program. Some of the particular things that the legislature approved in recent biennia, if you look at the budgets, there were additions that were approved in staffing specifically to assist the commission in providing better customer service in terms of loan guarantees services and that sort of thing. We were not aware during the prior legislative session that the situation was as grave as it actually was, and it did appear that the budget would provide enough revenue, that there were enough revenues anticipated, that there certainly would not need to have the commission shut down during its loan program during this current biennium, as it turned out it eventually had to do. But as Mr. Clem mentioned, we only became aware of this very closely before the end of session. If the session had ended earlier, we wouldn't have even known during the session. And you will see that when the agency goes through its report on budget notes, that the Legislative Assembly last session, or the Ways and Means Committee, did add a budget note when it became aware of the situation, basically directing the commission to report back to the emergency board on what was going on. During this process, I think the commission dealt with a very difficult process, of course. As you can see, the program had made the majority of the commission's employees were involved in administering this loan program. It was only a minority that were involved in the commission's other programs, which is primarily the Opportunity Grant, the Private Awards, and the Aspire programs. And the Office of Degree Authorization. Those are the four major programs that remain. And I think that the commission reported back several times to the emergency board during the interim on this review. I think they faced a number of challenges, and they have been able to successfully transition out of the loan program. And as Mr. Clem said, these remaining liabilities, my understanding was I didn't realize that all of the audit issues had been completed yet, but that primarily the state's fiscal position in this has been protected as far as we know.
So just a follow-up then. I mean, sounds like there wasn't really a plan to react to the market forces beforehand. There's still market forces that you're out there going to be subjected to. You now have a flexible business plan of some sort or some sort of plan to handle all these things that are going to happen in the future or that we don't know they're going to happen?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, the loan program is a function that no longer will be done by an Oregon state agency. This is now basically moved to the private sector. And in looking at what's being proposed at the federal level in terms of the coming federal fiscal year's budget, just in the nick of time, because the proposed budget would further reduce reimbursement rates and further reduce the or increase the funds that have to be transferred from the guarantee agencies to the federal government. So in talking with the folks that we've been working with as we've been exiting the program, they see a number of other states following shortly behind us in terms of this process. In my realm of looking at these types of things, in human health and human services, when the states meet and work, we're all working towards finding common and effective answers to our questions. When guarantee agencies get together, it's more of a business association where they're all competitors. And so there is not the same kind of collaboration and sharing to develop the most effective and efficient mechanisms, because they're all trying to take each other's market share. And so it's a much more competitive rather than collaborative work structure, and I think that's really what's led to many of the difficulties since the mid-90s. As I understand from folks who've been in the program a long time, prior to that, there was much more collegiality and common problem-solving. But as they moved to this more private model, a very different dynamic.
Now, you have a business plan, or you have a plan now to do. Is that something you can share with this committee?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, now our business plan is to really become more entrepreneurial in the area of the scholarships administration, to really expand those opportunities for students, and also to oversee the NEED grant program in the most effective and efficient way possible as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Gordley, ma'am, how would you, I think just to follow up on Representative Jensen's question, there seems to be a great many more scholarships out there than your folks or your commission is actually dealing with. How would you, in your business plan, access those other scholarships and coordinate their implementation by other students?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think the way in which we need to do that is close collaboration with high school counseling offices. These are areas of our local K-12 educational system that have declining resources. And I think the more in which we can work with them on local community resources that would like to do scholarships services, the better we can identify who are those granting organizations or scholarship organizations that are not finding an adequate student base of new applicants. The better we can partner with them, create that common application, the more students can, again, through a single application, access a very wide arena of opportunities. And hopefully then we would find students who meet those very individual qualifications that each of those granting organizations are hoping to see. I also hear kind of a mixed review in terms of, are there really scholarships that go unclaimed? In talking with many of the people in the financial aid arena in higher education, they don't see that as much. And so some of that may be mythology as opposed to actual fact. So we, again, would really like to explore all of those opportunities, though, because we don't want to see students in Oregon missing opportunities that someone would like to help them with their education.
Follow-up?
Yes. Have you contacted, I'm sorry, Chair Gordon, have you contacted the Department of Education, and are you in the process of setting up that relationship with the counselors in the secondary schools?
If let me take a stab at one thing, if I might, Madam Chair. One of my commissioners passed me a note, so I better read what he had to say. And Vicki Merkel is really the most appropriate person to answer your question, because she invented the program that you're just asking about and has grown it to where it's at now. But there is a large network in, I think we're now up to 68 high schools? 59 high schools in Oregon. It's completely privately funded without state taxpayer expense through private foundations and AmeriCorps. And I think, how many volunteers do we have?
688.
There are 688 volunteers already working all over Oregon informing high school students on kind of a mentoring basis of what their options are for college. And Vicki really should be the one to talk about it, because she should be very proud of what she's created. But there is a network of financial aid-related mentors out there helping students understand all their options, not just what the Student Assistance Commission offers, but what else is offered in their community. And we work very closely with the Oregon Community Foundation, which is in Portland and has a large number of their donors interested in the same area, where they will work in donor development and continuing to make sure that their donors' funds therefore transfer to Oregon students by using our services in as kind of an administrator. So they work to continue to expand donors and continue to make sure that folks, when they do want to make charitable gifts, think about higher education gifts versus, you know, the other kinds of programs that are out there people could give their philanthropic dollars to. And then we work with them very closely to administer the funds that they have developed through their outreach efforts. And so it's kind of a public-private partnership where, in the future, I see as our agency restructures, there is an opportunity for us to use somebody who specializes in finding donors, and we can specialize in administering the dollars and not have both entities doing both things, with neither one necessarily being, you know, completely entirely successful because the other one's working in the same arena, and we end up going after the same donors. And I think, again, when Vicki gets up here, she could speak to Aspire. I think it's part of the presentation, and it's something that is to be proud of.
Thank you, Mr. Glenn.
When Ms. Merkel does come forward, it would be good to hear what percentage of, you said you have outreach to 59 high schools, 688 volunteers reaching 59 high schools. What percentage is that of all high schools? So we have some better idea of what your penetration truly is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So back to the loan program. You can see here the key dates in terms of OSAC exiting the loan program, working closely in cooperation with Educational Credit Management Corporation to cause as little disruption as possible to the literally thousands of student loan holders that we have across Oregon. As we mentioned before, there are a number of variety of tasks that have to be done in order to oversee the loan program, including guaranteeing new loans, taking care of the existing loans, trying to prevent loan default, and then trying to do collections for those loans if they do actually go into default. I think we've already covered many of the different issues that contributed to Oregon needing to leave the loan program, so I'll skip past this slide. To talk a little bit about the process in exiting the loan program, as I mentioned, there was the Futures Work Group that met throughout the summer in order to come to the conclusions about what needed to be the focus of the commission in the future and also to explore alternatives on the loan program side. In order to exit the loan program, we needed to reach agreement with the union because the Attorney General's Office and the DAST, the Department of Administrative Services Labor Relations, advised us that this would be a contracting out change and would need to be addressed as one of the articles in the current collective bargaining agreement. We reached agreement with the union by late September and went to work immediately to release a request for proposals. Had 9 different guarantee agencies come to a mandatory bidders conference here in Salem in, I think, early November, but unfortunately we did not receive any bid proposals from any of those entities by December 3rd, which was the due date for those proposals to come in. We then had very soon discussions with the Federal Department of Education to talk about alternatives around how to continue to manage Oregon's exit from the program. Federal legislation allows the Department of Education to designate a single vendor to be the subsequent guarantee organization, and they did that within a week of or having those discussions with them, and that's how we began the work with the Education Credit Management Corporation. In this transition process, and you know, this has all been in the last 6 months, so this has been a very fast-paced, intense process. As we went into this discussion, Oregon had over $6 million of pending federal liabilities from previous audits and previous actions in terms of repayments that were required by the Department of Education that the agency had not been able to fully execute. Taking care of those potential liabilities was obviously a very key interest to all of us in order to not create a deeper financial situation for the state. Our current negotiations with ECMC, which are just days away from being fully executed, has a plan where the remaining balances that were in what was called the federal fund and the operating fund, these were the two resources under which we paid for the cost for the federal student loan program. Those two resources will be used entirely, and then any remaining balances will be covered out of a special fund that the Education Credit Management Corporation has, leaving Oregon basically at a break-even on the exit. Some of the members of the committee will recall that we did a presentation on the exit to the emergency board meeting in the very beginning of January. At that meeting, we actually asked for funds to cover some of our transition costs related to paying the unemployment compensation for employees and AG costs and other related expenditures that we were going to have once we no longer had access to either of those two resources that we used to pay for the program, that federal and operating fund. It has worked out where probably 90% of the expenses are actually going to be paid also directly by the Education Credit Management Corporation, again preserving the state's general fund as money that will be basically an ending balance to the state from the agency at the conclusion of this biennium. One of the areas where we could have had very substantial liabilities was around the transition costs for our employees. At the point in time in which the Education Credit Management Corporation took over, we still had 30-some employees that were employed by the loan program. The state, as many of you are aware, does not prepay its unemployment insurance costs. We pay those costs on a recovery basis once the cost has actually been incurred. So potentially we face 6 months of unemployment compensation liability for those employees at that layoff point. But because of very close work with the union and a consultant that we had brought in, we managed to reduce that number of potential unemployed individuals down so that only three individuals ended up not being placed at the conclusion. So we consider that to be a great win for the state general fund, but also a real benefit in terms of lack of hardship to those affected employees.
I'm going to stop you right there just for a moment. Members, we're going to have a floating gavel for a few minutes this morning. I'm passing the gavel to Senator Nelson, and please go through the chair.
Questions?
No,
please continue.
Unless the committee has any questions further about the loan program, at this point we would transition into a discussion about the Grants and Scholarships Division program.
Okay, so you just want to know the loan program's gone away.
We have exited that business, and fortunately at a breaking
point.
Yes. I can't imagine what it would have been like trying to craft a plan that would keep us out of the red in the coming biennium with what's proposed at the federal level.
I guess the other question I have is, you have crafted a plan for this new process. That's what you're going to explain to us now. This is basically your business plan for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, the Aspire Program, and Scholarship Service.
Yes, that is correct, Mr. Chairman.
And your purpose is to increase access for the growing number of students in need.
Yes.
I'm just reading that off.
At this point, Vicki Merkel, who is the administrator of the Grants and Scholarships section, will join me too. She has a very high level of passion for all of these programs. So, there are so many students who are affected by this, and at the committee's direction in the last legislative session, you ask us to develop performance measures to really help you understand what we achieve by that. And I would tell you that the data that we have coming in is very exciting information about what a difference this makes for so many students in Oregon. It's something that the committee and the governor should really be commended on how you're helping make students, people who can be very productive members of our communities and our state, and really with much smaller needs in the future and hopefully a much greater contribution.
Okay. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vicki Merkel. I am the Grants and Scholarships Division Director, and I've been in this position for a year. Prior to that, I was hired to design and implement the Aspire program, and I joined the agency in 1998 to do so. Before that, I spent 25 years in social services, and that's both my disclaimer that I'm not a financial aid resource person. I'm going to be walking you through some financial aid information, however, and also a claim that I am passionate about these programs because as a first-generation college attender myself, I believe that the programs I'm about to describe to you really do change the lives of students, their families, and their communities. The goals of the Grants and Scholarships Division are to provide, as Margie has talked to you about, the need-based financial aid to Oregon's really neediest students through the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We also are unique in that we provide efficient design and administration of gift aid or scholarships, and we also administer a number of public programs that I will be describing. And as Brian mentioned, the Aspire program and our outreach efforts provide information to help Oregonians as they strive to meet their educational needs. Now, why is all of this important? It's important to Oregon because a projection of new jobs required in the future. If you'll notice here, we have 32,188 jobs are projected to require a bachelor's degree, while only 3,266 will be work experience only. So it appears that we have a choice to either grow our own educator workforce or import them. Higher education equals higher learning. If you look at this chart here at the bottom, we go from the bottom to the top in terms of educational attainment. On the left-hand side, you'll see that the unemployment rate declines the higher educated the workforce. In addition, so do the earnings of the worker, the higher education that they have. This also increases state resources. Unfortunately, as the need for a higher educated workforce has increased, so has tuition and fees. This chart is just tuition and fees for the three sectors, the OUS system, community colleges, and independent not-for-profit. Currently, in 2004-05, tuition and fees at OUS is $5,036. By the way, these numbers are self-reported to us by the institutions based upon the financial aid criteria of full-time, which tends to be 12 credit hours. Now, I looked at these numbers and I thought, what does this really mean to me? What was tuition like when I went to school? So I went Googling around the internet and I found that historical database of tuition and fees for the Oregon University systems back to 1975, which really isn't quite as far back as when I graduated. So I didn't know I was so old I was falling off the historical charts, but I did. So in 1975 at the University of Oregon, tuition was $647 for the year. Portland State was $1 more, and Oregon State was $8 less. What does that translate? Well, I Googled around and found a consumer price index calculator. In today's dollars, that's $2,349. So even if we'd maintain on that trajectory, we've more than doubled the price of tuition and fees. So if any of you are as old as I am, you may remember when we used to be able to work summers and actually pay for a year of college. It seems pretty difficult to do that. Now, I have two college kids, and I tell you, they can't make even $5,000 in a summer. Interestingly enough, in 1985, and I used the U of O because that's where I graduated from, but the tuition and fees in today's dollars was only $2,700. So in a decade, it only rose a little less than, or about $350. And then there's been this dramatic incline in tuition and fees. In our division, the work that we do really does help Oregon students go to college through our programs. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is our main avenue for financial aid to the neediest students in Oregon. In your packet, I've included a FAFSA form. This is the free application for federal student aid. This is the first step for students to apply for federal, for any type of financial aid, including our OSAC scholarships, the Pell Grants, Work Study, and Student Loans. It's a daunting form. Many people feel that it's more difficult than a tax form. I highly recommend that people do it online. Not only is it easier and it's self-correcting and won't let you go from one screen to the next, but also because if you're fortunate enough to be a working parent or even have two working parents, when you receive that calculation of what the federal government tells you you should be able to afford to pay for college, it's best that you're sitting down.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would agree with you 100%, Ms. Merkel, because I filled that form out for my children for each 4 years they went to school. Plus, I believe when I was in school, we had some different form in the 70s. I don't remember that. But you're exactly right. It's pretty frightening when a parent finally gets that. I'm supposed to come up with that.
Exactly.
It is very scary, so I appreciate what you're telling us here. And you are not old enough to have fallen off the historical charts. But I love that line, and I wrote it down for future reference. Thank you.
Senator Gordley.
Yeah, what is the percentage of applications completed online?
For the FAFSA record?
Mm-hmm.
For Oregon students?
Yes.
I'll have to get back to you with that percentage, if I may.
I'd be curious to know that. We assume sometimes that everyone has access to a computer, and we know that isn't true. And so I'd be interested to know what that actually looks like.
You mean the difference, Chair Gordley, you mean the difference between students who apply online and those who do a paper application?
Yes.
Or the number of students in Oregon compared to those who complete a FAFSA?
Online
versus
the
okay.
Yeah.
One of the things that we do know is that students will, or families, will sometimes complete the FAFSA the first year, and then after they see the expected family contribution, they give up and they don't continue to complete it.
Mm-hmm.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Merkel, are you responsible, or could you give us information about the Northwest, how the exchange students can go to any school in certain states at the same rate or something? Does that come under you, or does that should be asked the university system?
Yeah, Chair Gordley, Representative Wissett, that's a program of the Oregon University Systems, the WICHE program. We simply share that information through our outreach, but we don't administer that program.
Follow up.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the people applying for our loans could not use that and go to Washington State or Idaho or...
Our opportunity grant, Chair Gordley and Representative Wisnett, our opportunity grant is only for Oregon students attending an Oregon school headquartered in Oregon, and only undergraduate students.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
I did have another question, and it was the question, a follow-up to the question raised earlier by Senator Whitsitt, and it was the... There are 59 high schools being reached with information about scholarship opportunities. And the question was, what percentage is that of all high schools in the state?
Chair Devlin, I apologize. I the gavel floated and I wasn't staying current. And Senator Gordley.
It's a compliment either way.
My understanding is, and I'd like to verify this number, that there are a little over 300 both private and public schools. It does seem to be a floating number when you look at when you start adding in charter schools, alternative schools, and the smaller faith-based schools. I believe our public schools are at about 250. We started Aspire in 4 schools in 98-99, and we've been able to increase to 59 schools. We do have other outreach materials that go and are available to the general public that I'll talk about also.
And again, what I'm trying to better understand is, what does our outreach look like overall, and is the outreach organized in a way that provides equal access of information to the population that would be served by the opportunity? And what I'm hearing is that that's uneven.
The Aspire program is targeted to high school students, but we also do outreach to college on college campuses through community-based presentations. We work with our partner, the Ford Family Foundation.
It's the high school population that I'm asking about, the outreach to the high school students. That's what I'm trying to...
Mr. Chair and Senator Gorley, you might want to take a look at page 50. Oh, I know I'm jumping ahead, but that gives you a visual of where the high schools are at, spread throughout Oregon. 51 shows the program growth. I think your point's well taken, and we would like to be able to do Aspire in every high school. As I think some of you know, we don't receive any federal fund for any of these high schools. And so part of it is our ability to attract foundations, private donors, the federal government's AmeriCorps program, and then to talk the school districts into believing it's a value and providing the match that they need is what's sort of shaping our growth. And it's fairly meteoric, I would say, actually, compared for having no state resources to accomplish any of this. But what we found was the high schools themselves, in preparing their folks for college, they're ill-funded and that they've got huge counselor-to-student ratios. So we invented this. I shouldn't say we. I should say Vicky invented this as a way to try and solve that problem. And we're growing it at the rate we can talk private entities into funding it. But we would be more than happy to expand it to greater areas with additional funding.
I just think, Mr. Chair, that in the presentation of the information, it's helpful if you also tell us what the need looks like, what the overall need is compared to what you're actually able to service now. That's the point that I'm trying to get at. Because what I'm hearing from you is that there's 300 and some schools, high schools.
Okay. So we're missing 240.
That's the point.
That's right.
That's what I'm trying to hammer on.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, we like to say in the Aspire program that it's not a matter of if a school will become an Aspire program, but when. And as we've been able to increase private funding, our intent is to continue to add schools. But there's definitely more work to be done.
It also looks like, Mr. Chair, if you live in a certain area of the state, you don't have an opportunity. Again, looking at the map, the Aspire map, if you live in eastern Oregon or southeastern Oregon, I know there have got to be high schools out there, you don't have the opportunity. So, well, the point's been made.
I might comment one thing on the FAFSA. It's been my experience that, and I don't know if this is entirely true, but having had done a number of these, is that doing it online, the return time is considerably shorter than sending it in paper form, so you get an answer back more quickly and you get your report sent out to schools more quickly.
Chair Devlin, that's correct. This year, it's almost immediate. As soon as you submit, you get an estimated family contribution via email.
The other thing that I have found is for those parties that are, say, of middle economic class, when you get the parental contribution, and if your child is going to a private school, that should be probably your low mark in terms of what the parental contribution is, because I've known a number of parents I've talked to, and including my own situation, where the parental contribution has exceeded the parental one from FAFSA by about 25%. So, just as a comment.
To continue with the Oregon Opportunity Grant information, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is the FAFSA record holder for the state. Any student who fills out the FAFSA and marks their state of residence as Oregon, their record is transmitted to us electronically. For the opportunity grant, we do not use that estimated family contribution. We use other data points that are given to us through the FAFSA, family income and household size. In addition to meeting financial needs, students must also be Oregon residents, undergraduates, again enrolled in a post-secondary institution in Oregon, and while they're in school, they must maintain satisfactory academic progress. We prepared four case studies here on the Opportunity Grant on public funding. I'm going to very quickly walk through those with you. These are real students. We've changed their names. The four case studies are a handout following your FAFSA. We're looking at just the public programs, and you'll see if you do the math here, some of these students have a financial gap that they would have to fill from other sources, such as federal work study, institutional aid, private scholarships, or family resources. It's important to note that 91% of the students currently eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant are from families with that EFC of less than $1,000. And 72% have a zero EFC. So the Oregon Opportunity Grant is targeting Oregon's neediest students and their families. Case study number one, Shauna is a 23-year-old who's currently attending a four-year private independent school. Her parents have a family income of $29,923, and she also earns some summer money. Her EFC is $28, so she is eligible for a maximum Pell Grant using the federal methodology. The Oregon Opportunity Grant methodology does not take into account the student's income because these are the neediest students in Oregon. A decision was made that to assume that these students' monies were going to contribute to the family and to basic support. In order to administer the Oregon Opportunity Grant with limited resources, we have to use cutoff dates. The FAFSA is filed. The FAFSA filing date is transmitted to us. And if you think of the FAFSA filing date as lining up students in a very long line, we take that line and we break it into three segments, the public 4 years, private 4 years, and two-year community colleges. Then we have, based on historical data, a calculation we make that tells us how many students in that line we will be able to serve. It's very important in our outreach efforts that we explain to families that they must do the FAFSA as close to January 1 as possible to get at the head of the line so that they can receive our resources. So Shauna would be able to get her federal grant of $4,050 at any type of school that she attends, but with our current funding limitations and the way we manage the program, she has a different size of Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is figured at 11% of the average cost of attendance for each segment. On page two, Carl, student number two, is a 31-year-old single independent student who's retraining for a new career. He's in his last year of a four-year institution. His income is $5,182, so he will also receive the maximum Pell Grant. His income falls below our income threshold, and I'll show you that current chart in just a moment. He filed his FAFSA on February 6, so he could also would be in line soon enough to receive a grant at either a four-year or public or private school. Because he's in his fourth year, you'll notice that he's eligible for more loans. The student loans that a student is eligible for, the amount actually goes up as they progress through their education. Linda, student number three, is a 44-year-old single parent. She's in her second year at a community college. Her income is $18,720. She's also eligible for the maximum Pell. However, she filed her FAFSA on July 16th, so the only segment that she would be eligible for an opportunity grant for would be the community colleges. Student number four is a 19-year-old dependent student. He started his first year of college at a four-year private school. His family income is $42,259, and he earned $2,377. So his estimated family contribution is still under $1,000 at $908. His Pell Grant then is stair-stepped down to $3,100. The Pell Grant operates on a slope with the minimum Pell Grant being $400. He's eligible to receive an Oregon Opportunity Grant at any school.
A couple of questions. One, I know that schools, when they give out financial aid awards, do at least randomly audit FAFSAs in terms of their accuracy, in terms of depicting a family's income. Do you know if that is that entirely random, and what percentages are audited, or?
Chair Devlin, I do believe it is a random, it's called verification,
right.
And I could find out the percentages for you and bring that information back.
Okay. And do you know if there's any cross-reference between FAFSA and, like, actual tax returns? I mean, do we do any cross-reference?
Chair Devlin, at this time there's not, but there is talk of moving towards that system.
Okay. And the last question, could we get some average numbers, and I think they're relatively high, for particularly four-year students at both private and public universities in terms of their average debt on graduation?
Chair Devlin, my understanding that at a public school, the Oregon University System, the average is between $15,000 and $17,000 for a four-year for a bachelor's degree. I'm not sure what it is for a private school. I can also look that up for you. There are private schools who require a second form called the profile, and I do believe that those schools may also request income tax information, but it's not cross-referenced with the FAFSA. These are the opportunity grant funding sources, and of course our main source is general fund dollars, and in the governor's budget you can see quite an increase, which would allow us to not have those cutoff dates. We'll be able to serve all students. The dedicated lottery funds, we experienced a decrease in those funds as the trust fund was no longer available. Our federal funds are not guaranteed to us. That's something that the federal government looks at in their budget, and it is a match for state dollars. So we may or may not receive those depending on how many state dollars are given to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The voucher program is the Jobs Plus program, and again, that we saw a dramatic decrease in the last biennium because there was a one-time decision to take the expired voucher dollars and return them to the general fund rather than the Oregon Opportunity Grant. This chart explains how we figure out the income eligibility for the student. We use a percentage of median family income. We average a three-year number from the U.S. Census Bureau. For a dependent student, the median percentage of median family income that we currently use is 55%. A dependent student is one who does not meet the definition for the other two students. So I'm going to describe those. I think that's a little bit easier way. An independent student is a student who is married and or has children. A single student is one who is over 24, an orphan or a ward of the court, a veteran or a graduate student. In 01, in 02, 03, because of a lack of funding, we actually froze the median family income to the 01, 02 level. So that's why you see a little bit of a percentage dip there. And then in 03, 04, we had to reduce the median family income for dependent students to 55%. We call these the hydraulics. This is how we manage the funds in order to serve the most students possible, but still with an award that is significant enough that it will make a difference to the student. This chart explains how these shifting hydraulics.
Thank you. You said in above that you'll be able to serve all students, and when we look at the number that you've had to reduce, are you saying that you're going to be able to move this 55% line up, or are you going to serve everybody at 11%, or what's the...
Senator Devlin, Representative March, the current modeling is at the current 55% median family income for dependent students, and at 11% cost of attendance.
Okay,
it's our starting point. We would like to get back to 75%, and that's the long-term goal, as more funds, should more funds become available.
Please proceed.
This grant, this chart shows that if you look at the red bars, had we continued on the trajectory of serving at 75% median family income for dependents and had not had to freeze that income that 1 year, we would have been serving more students. In 2004-05, it's estimated that we will serve 18,544 students. The lavender bar is the eligible applicants, and then the dark black are the award recipients. Okay. These are the current income eligibility thresholds for projected for 2005-06. And again, I would remind you that 91% of these students will have an EFC of $1,000 or less. So our current awarding principles are to create awards that cover an equal percentage of costs of attendance among the three segments, which is currently 11%, and to make awards equal to an equal number of students for each segment. I've included general information about the Oregon Opportunity Grant in the back of this section if you'd like to reference that at a later time.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
In relationship to the opportunity grants and need-based, do you have a sense of how many students there are that whose families' incomes would be too high to make them eligible for any of the need grant programs, who become independent students to take on the necessary vows of poverty so that they qualify for need grant? My question's clear.
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, I think you're asking how many students might delay college so that they can have independent status? Or
how many become independent? Independent is single, right? Yeah. How many, you know?
Might get married or?
No.
I got him. Senator Devlin, Representative Jensen, what you want to know is, do people get away from their parents' income tax return so they're no longer dependents and they become independents just to get financial aid, is what you're concerned about. Yeah. I'll have to get you sort of some more official answers, but we already lower the percentage of the median family income if you're a single independent. It's not the same ratio. So when you basically try and swear off your parents' income, which is not something you can just do by saying that, the financial aid office will to some extent determine whether you are a dependent or not for you based on your parents' status and whether you're receiving funds, those types of things. But we already lower our percentage, assuming that once you no longer are part of a dependent situation, that you have kind of entered voluntary poverty. And so I think the rate is, you can be, yeah, 30% if you're a single. If you are a single independent person, then you can only be up to 30% of the median family income. And then if you're dependent, you can be up to 55%. And so we kind of build into the factor to not make it advantageous to lose your parents' income by dropping the percentage down, if that makes sense. I can see if we can get some more hard numbers from a financial aid office on what, you know, they experience. But I know they have some tests to try and control for that as well there.
I'd be, you know, quite interested in that. It's not a matter of that this is an iffy situation that students do this, because it is a matter that students do this. And I'm not making any sort of, accusation as to the merits or lack of thereof. As far, just curious if, you know, what kind of information, what kind of controls or allowances or whatever it is that you have to deal with this particular issue.
That's a good question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bender has a follow-up also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think it might be a little clearer if we clarified a bit the for this particular program itself, the opportunity grant, how you qualify for that particular grant. Unlike other types of financial aid, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you are not married, then whether you're considered dependent or independent is a function of your age generally, and that therefore a person who is under 24 would not be eligible under the opportunity grant to say they are not dependent on their parents and to therefore exclude their family income. They typically would not be able to do this if they were not married and just had not reached that age yet. Is that correct? I think there may be some exceptions if you're, like you mentioned, an orphan.
That's correct. And financial aid officers do have the ability to make a professional judgment. My experience has been in attending training sessions with them and talking with them. They're very careful about that, and they would only do so if there is an issue, for example, where a student doesn't know where their parents are. You know, maybe their parents have abandoned them, so they are not able to get a FAFSA completed with their parents' income. We follow for the Oregon Opportunity Grant the same criteria as the federal FAFSA criteria for independent and dependent. And you could even be a 23-year-old who's been working on your own and you have bought your own house, and you're still considered a dependent by federal methodology because you're not 24.
Okay. We also do have the example, obviously, of students who are 20, 21 years old, who their parents, if you file a FAFSA, might have a very substantial contribution, and they'll file the FAFSA, but their parents will refuse to make any contribution.
Right.
And they cannot be compelled to make any contribution. The only people that I understand that can be compelled are people that are non-custodial parents that are paying child support can be compelled until, I believe, a child is 24 years old to actually pay towards the education. But I have seen students, I have had constituent contacts from students where parents were clearly able to make substantial contributions but refused to make any contribution to their child's education. I mean, it's unfortunate, but it does happen.
So true. Over to our next thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Last legislative session, the agency was asked by the Education Subcommittee to look into basically the question of, should the award sizes at independent institutions be limited to the amount at public institutions? And this issue has a long history. It's been done both ways. There's been separate programs just to private institutions, and then they were merged back in, so it was just one program with a formula people compromised on. And so when they asked us to do this, I wasn't looking forward to the task because I knew it would open a can of worms. But we went, and we did 8 public hearings where people commented on this topic. They were in Portland, Salem, Pendleton, LeGrand, Grants Pass, Medford, Eugene, Roseburg, twice in Bend. And we had lots of spirited debate. And there were lots of folks from the different schools, folks from the community, media people were sometimes commenting on their opinion. It seemed like everybody had an opinion on this topic. And so we took all of that in and then essentially deliberated over everything we heard in public hearing and made a report. The entire report's in the back of your program, but I thought what I could do is just summarize the I forgot one other group. We have an opportunity grant advisory group that is made up of financial aid professionals in the different sectors. Their expertise generally is more related to implementation and the effects on their students if you were to make various changes. Because the second part of the report was, if you were going to make such a change, how would you implement that? How would that change be implemented? And so the commission basically recommends a process where we do move to a basically artificial cap for the private institutions at the public school institutions. We believe that it's important that you grandfather and protect to the greatest extent possible the students who are already receiving an award amount while they finish their education. And the process that we believe that we were on a track for in the governor's recommended budget is basically to bring the other institutions up over the course of several biennia while holding the private school students' grants basically artificially down at a level that matches and tracks with the four-year public institution grant size. We know that if the outcome of the budgets in various years don't achieve that, there may need to be a revisiting, but there is a statute on the books that controls that at this point, and there will be a bill coming forward out of the governor's office, I believe, that will recommend a change to how that statute works to provide flexibility to essentially bring the other schools up at a much higher rate while holding the private schools in place. It's my great pleasure to introduce at this point to you Tim Nesbitt, who was the co-chair of the Oregon University Systems Access and Affordability Workgroup. And as I think you gathered from our earlier conversations, that my commissioners and I were fairly busy this last year getting out of the loan business. And so we were exceptionally appreciative of this group's effort to study and analyze financial aid, because sometimes when you're administering a grant, you get stuck in the mechanics of what you're doing, and you don't really stop to think about the large scope, big picture financial aid. And that's where this work group was just phenomenal. And I participated as a resource, but I'd like to have Tim share with you their work and conclusions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Nesbitt. I'm a member of the State Board of Higher Education, and I co-chaired our board's Access and Affordability Work Group, which included more than members of our own board, but also representatives of a number of sectors and organizations. Some of those persons who committed a lot of time, we've had 11 meetings over the last 11 months, are in the room today. I recognized Randy Choi from the Oregon Community Foundation, Gary Andine from the Independent Colleges Association, John Wyckoff from the Oregon Student Association, and Julie Sahanek from the Community College Association. I hope I didn't leave anybody out who's in the room who worked with us, and a number of others who participated as resource people as well. We began with the charge from our board to look seriously at the affordability gap that has developed over the years for our public institutions in Oregon, our post-secondary public institutions. And what got our attention when I took my seat on the board about 13 months ago was that Oregon rated an F in the national study called Measuring Up for Affordability, down from a D minus in 2000. That was the 2002 report. Since then, the 2004 report came out, and we did even worse, another F. And if you look at how we compare to other states, we've even moved down the scale, so that now a post-secondary education at a public institution is more affordable in 34 other states than it is in Oregon. And so if we view ourselves as competing in terms of the future success of our economy and the future skills of our workforce by how we're doing vis-a-vis other states in getting our young people and even our older adults through college, we're not doing very well. We're moving in the wrong direction if that's our goal. When we looked at the reasons for the increasingly worsening affordability gap in Oregon, we found that some of it can be explained by the fact that we, as a state, have slightly lower than average personal income, therefore a little bit less of an ability to pay. But we also have higher than average tuition, especially when you look at our neighboring states in the West. Nationally, I would say we're slightly higher than average, but in the West, we're much higher than average in our tuition. And then the most telling statistic of all was that when you look at what other states do by way of providing need-based financial aids to their residents, need-based financial aid, like the Oregon Opportunity Grant, to their residents, we are much, much behind, much lower than average. The consequences, obviously, for that increasing affordability gap are severe. We've calculated that in the 1990s, after tuition started going up rapidly in the wake of Measure 5, there was a lost generation of graduating high school students and students who were completing 2 years of community college who were prepared and had proven their ability to be able to go on to college to a four-year institution, but didn't do so. And they numbered 12,000 in the first half of that decade in the 1990s. We did better in the late part of the decade. And in 1999, in the earlier chart, you saw how the tuition increases moderated. They were 3% or 1.5%. And attendance grew. We became a little more affordable. But now we're looking again in the wake of continuing budget pressures at even greater increases in tuition, far above the rate of increase in personal income in the state. And that's what's driving that affordability gap even wider. We're looking now over the next 5 years at the possible reemergence of another lost generation of students numbering 9,000. By the calculations from the Chancellor's office, just in terms of those we'd expect to see showing up at our public four-year institutions who may not be able to do so. Again, going back to when I talked about the three factors which make our post-secondary education in Oregon less affordable, and focused on that gap in terms of our own state's effort for need-based financial aid, I don't have this in chart form. I think we'll be back in front of you when the Higher Ed Board comes before you, starting later this week or next week, and we'll have more of these in chart form. But the one statistic I wanted to share with you that is this. Nationally, the average that states commit to state-funded need-based financial aid for each enrolled undergraduate is $354 per enrolled undergraduate resident student. In Oregon, our effort amounts to $133. In California, it's $367, and in Washington State, it's $483. So you can see that.
What was the Oregon number again?
$133. So one measure of the kind of gap we have to close here is just in terms of what we as a state do to provide, and we're a high-tuition state now, provide assistance to those who can least afford to meet the cost of tuition. One way, of course, is to work your way through school, and Vicki Merkel talked a little bit about what everybody's experience is now. Here's a statistic I'd like to share with you. Back in the 1960s and 70s, a student could work through the summer at a minimum wage job and work about 15 hours a week during school, 15 to 16 hours a week, and work his or her way through college. Now that same student would have to work about 45 hours a week year-round, all 52 weeks of the year. It's not possible to do that, which again is why we see more part-time students. I want to talk about the importance of addressing the needs of part-time students as well. Those who are working their way through college now are more likely to be going to school part-time. So in our work group, and in coordination with the work that OSAC was doing and the hearings they were holding about how the Oregon Opportunity Grant might be better designed and restructured, if I can just cut to the bottom line of our recommendations, first of all, we concluded that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is, in fact, a very good vehicle for need-based financial aid. We should stay with it, and we should work with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and how they administer that program. Secondly, obviously, we need to increase the reach of that program to reach more of our needy students. We need to work in the short term to eliminate these calendar cutoffs you heard about, so that those who are, you know, those students who are on the fence and, you know, may or may not be, you know, are deciding whether or not they can afford it, are more likely to take a little time before they commit, and those are the ones who lose the benefit when the calendar cutoff arises. And the same is true of part-time students. They're not currently eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We think it's a very important short-term goal to try and bring them into the equation. We also are recommending, in order to not only do more but do better, looking at ways that the federal grant, the Pell Grant, is structured for two reasons. One is that the Pell Grant takes into account a family's assets, not just its income. And that's a change that we're recommending that the Oregon Student Assistance Commission look at. But also, the Pell Grant doesn't have these cliffs where if you earn a dollar more in family income, you're ineligible. You go right to zero. The Pell Grant has a calculation of an expected family contribution and a slope. So that means if you're a little bit higher income, you get a little bit of help. And that, we think, is going to be a particular assistance to the lower middle income and middle income families who still struggle with the cost of meeting the tuition costs at our post-secondary institutions. We also looked at coordinating with the work of some of our other work groups, the excellence in productivity work group, looking to encourage that continuum between high school and community colleges and four-year colleges, and rewarding and encouraging better preparation. And there's an aspect of the recommendations that you'll see in the handout that addresses that. Also paying attention to the first generation of students, those the first in their families to go on to college. And finally, directing more resources, which is kind of another way of addressing the work that OSAC did in terms of how to structure the grant and whether to do a flat grant, directing more resources to our public institutions over time getting them to the point where really if you choose to go to a four-year public institution or community college, you're getting as much support as you might if you choose to go to a more expensive private college. Not to exceed the cost of tuition and fees was the caveat we placed on that. Now, to do all this, as you might imagine, given the differences in the magnitude of our state's commitment to need-based financial aid compared to other states, would probably mean an increase of three or four-fold from that $43 million or so that was committed in the current biennium. We don't have that much to work with, but we do have the governor's recommended budget, which is basically a doubling of the grant to $91.6 million. And my handout, if it's gotten to you while I've been talking, outlines how we propose to add dollars to the Oregon Opportunity Grant and do so in a way that's consistent with our findings and recommendations for the long term, consistent with the findings and recommendations that came from OSAC's hearing process. And in other words, we're not just recommending that you pour more money into the existing vessel here. We're also recommending that we restructure it, and we do so in a way which over time we'll get to that more and better program that we hope we can get to. There are these three features which we summarize in the handout. One is that for the time being, staying with the median family income cutoffs, but over the longer term wanting to get higher than this, we would propose that we increase the grant awards to the levels you see here, which are basically a 19% increase for community colleges, a 22% increase for our public four-year institutions, and a lesser increase of 6% at our private institutions. Eventually, as we start to calibrate these grant amounts to more to reflect the cost of tuition and fees at our public institutions, if we also, while we're doing that, commit to a maintenance of effort to what we're doing for students right now who choose to go to our private colleges, it's still an important part of the picture here. We can, over time, apportion these increases to the point where we're getting to more of a common maximum amount that that'll actually mean more to students who choose our lower-cost public institutions, but not really lead to pulling back, at least from the dollar amounts now committed, to students who choose to go to our private institutions. Secondly, to encourage students to take more challenging courses and be better prepared, we're recommending that beginning with the fall term in 05, we add a feature to the Oregon Opportunity Grant for those who are Oregon Opportunity Grant eligible of an extra $500 if they've completed the CIM, the Certificate of Initial Mastery, which is one indicator of better preparation for a community college or a four-year institution. And we've also found in other states that these kinds of one-time grants for enrolling freshmen can be highly cost-effective. It's only $500, but it's kind of the opposite of the sticker shock you get when a student looks at what tuition is. Well, $500 can also look quite attractive. And the study we did of best practices in other states suggests this is a cost-effective way of allocating some dollars and doing it in a different way. And finally,
Senator Walker.
Mr. Nesbitt, I want to catch you before you go on to the next issue. I just want to express a little concern about that. I mean, I think it's a neat idea. But I have toured some of these small rural coastal high schools, and they don't have the ability to offer the advanced calculus classes or those advanced courses that you're talking about here that are maybe challenging enough to qualify for this. So how would you address that?
Senator, I I don't know the K-12 system well enough, but what we're talking about here is a certificate of initial mastery, not the certificate of advanced mastery, and I would think that would be available in just about every high school.
I just want to make sure that the smaller schools have that opportunity for those children.
That's a good question. I'm not answering it with 100% certainty, but I think the certificate of initial mastery, I'm getting a nod yes from my right, is available in all high schools.
Okay.
And to homeschool students as well.
Chair Devlin?
And finally, I'm sorry.
Senator Whitsett had a question.
Chair Devlin, Mr. Nesbitt, two quick questions. One, going way back, you're talking about the rankings of the states. I think we should bring forward, I think there's only three states in that entire ranking of affordability that ranked above a D. That doesn't say anything for general education across the United States, but that's I think that's true. And then the second thing, on the plan to equalize grants to private and public institutions, it seems to me that there's kind of unlevels the playing field a little bit in that the public institutions, the Oregon University system, get money from from the state to supplement their procedures and their education ability, whereas the private systems generally do not. And so it seems that we're asking those private institutions to somewhat subsidize the education from that standpoint. Could you address that, please?
Senator, that point was debated frequently from both points of view, and I heard that point of view advanced in our work group. And I also heard advance the point of view that while we invest directly in our public institutions because we want to have affordable public institutions and we should put our effort there, I end up, maybe this sounds too diplomatic, but I end up thinking we can accomplish both. And actually what I wanted to end up my presentation by saying is that we have the agreement from all sectors to take this next step and structure it this way and to get to the point where we're recommending grants which aren't just calibrated according to what school you choose to attend, but are also designed to cover more students and enable more students to attend our post-secondary institutions of both public and private. So I think the way we're going here accomplishes that purpose and recognizes the value of the post-secondary education experience offered in both public and private colleges, even though we're having to adjust for the higher costs of the private colleges.
Hasn't there? I read a lot of the testimony from the hearings and talking to a number of students that have come to see me. There isn't a desire, clearly, to keep options available for students because, a broad spectrum of options, and I think you do that by actually at least coming up to some reasonable cost of attending a private institution in terms of the opportunity grant. If we were to lower them all, there would be a lot of students where attending a private institution, they could not just simply make it pencil out, regardless of how much they borrowed or regardless of what funds the private institution could provide to them. And I saw a sentiment within there to keep those options available to students.
Senator Devlin, the financial aid officers in those campuses have certainly told us repeatedly that you would definitely eliminate people from their campuses just with this one move alone. There's no doubt in their mind that it would make that impact. Then, as Tim described, you then balance that over time and additional investment and try and make it meaningful everywhere you go. That's the best plan we could get all parties to agree to, which I'll tell you, for I think 10 or 12 years now I've been involved in this particular battle. From the time I was a student, I've never seen agreement from all the sectors on a plan on how this can work that seems likely to hold.
I would ask also that you keep in the back of your mind and the parties that are in the room in the back of their mind that should we... I'm hoping that we stay very close to the governor's figure, but I don't think that's a guarantee in the end of this process about how you would approach it if it's somewhat less than the governor's figure in terms of what's proposed for this.
And Is that a question about?
It's almost a rhetorical question.
Okay, good. If I could just complete by calling your attention to the last of the three components we're recommending, and that is that we extend the eligibility for Oregon Opportunity Grants to part-time students, which, again, those are often the students who are working their way through college. And to exclude them now, I think, doesn't really recognize and reward their efforts. And so by making this change, we estimate that the Oregon Opportunity Grant would be able to serve 8,500 students who are now not served. And the predominant number of those are in our community college system. So we think this also is an important next step to take in terms of reaching more students and rewarding their effort.
Question from Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly would applaud the recognition here of the part-time students, and I particularly would applaud the fact that probably many of these, probably the majority of them, are community college students. Our view, excuse me, Mr. Chair, if I say that this looks to me like tokenism for the community college and part-time students. You're expanding the number of full-time, according to your figures, by 16,200, and the number of part-time coming into the scene by 8,500. You have a total of 57,700 full-time and a total of 8,500 part-time students. And the reality is that probably, and I don't have these figures, but it seems to me in looking at them, the majority of the students are probably, at least at the community college level now, part-time students. So I'm a little concerned at your distribution at this point, while applauding and recognizing that this is really the first time that part-time students have kind of gotten into the formula. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen, the number of part-time students covered flows from the income cutoffs. So those 55% of median family income for dependent students, the 30% for single dependent students, it's not as if we're trying to triage the part-time students. Having established those income eligibility levels and then saying you should be able to receive assistance even if you're part-time, we end up with 8,500 part-time students. I think if we wanted to cover more, we'd have to raise the income levels.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, we have asked this question of financial aid professionals who work with these students every day for years, and every time they've come back and said, you need to fund the full-time before you do the part-time. Now, this last year, we started to see some change. There were some cracks in that theory, and it wasn't uniform. It was on some campuses especially, and that's why the need for this program to come into effect at this time seems to us to be what we need to do. And I guess I share your sentiments that it's no longer obvious that part-time students should come second in line. And in this case, because of our income thresholds, this is slated to fund all of the people eligible in the part-times at that income level. And Tim's right. The only way to change that would be to adjust the income levels up. But we also have sort of a life raft ethic in this business that you need to cover the lower income folks. And once they're all covered, then you start to move the income threshold back up. But this would be a long-term goal that I think we share with you, that 8,000 is not enough, because there are a lot more than 8,000. It's just the income number makes it look artificially complete when it really isn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the clarification. I am a little surprised at the fact that the income numbers come out there, but without getting into those in some detail, I certainly wouldn't quarrel. I would wonder maybe if that 30% independent may be part of the consequences there, because that's where a lot of these people go, is to the community colleges.
And if I may add to that, I think that is one of the factors. The other factors are we're talking about being enrolled in a degree-granting program, and we're talking about being enrolled for at least 6 credit hours. So all of those help to define the eligible population.
Chair Devlin.
Yes, Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Mr. Nesbitt, to follow up on Representative Jensen's discussion, it seems that this plan acts as a disincentive to work your way through college. You know, the more successful you are at being employed and increasing your income, the less available funds are to help you.
The current system was absolutely horrific in that manner. It said that if you work so much that you can only take part-time, you get nothing from the state, zero. You're not eligible for a grant, period. What we believe we're doing is improving and saying if you will work, then you can now get a grant to help offset your work. You know, and it may be that what you're arguing for is you sort of tilt it the other way and say if you're working X number of hours, maybe that's the larger grant rather than the smaller. We feel compared to where we were at and where we're currently at for this year that we are improving the incentive to go ahead and work some, which is going to mean you can only take somewhere 6, 7, 8, 9 credits. And we think we're going to do better in that regard. But I think you're probably right that in the long term, when you choose to work instead of go completely full-time, your aid does suffer.
Senator, I would add, when we get to that longer-term goal of being able to structure the grant so that an extra dollar of income doesn't completely wipe you out of eligibility and leave you with zero, but have a slope where at least you get some assistance, that too, I think, will be especially helpful to the part-time students and the independent students.
Thank you.
Yes. And then Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first I apologize for needing to be out of the hearing room for a few minutes to talk with the Senate President. I have a request of Mr. Nesbitt, and welcome. Are you familiar with Senate Bill 300, which is currently in the Senate Education Committee, Expanded Options? It's a concept that's been around for several sessions. It would allow for students in high school, grades 11 and 12, students who are at risk, even students who have dropped out, and also students who are working on their STEM CAM, to have the opportunity to take a course or courses at a community college or university and have the fees paid by the sending high school or district. I'm wondering if you would take a look at that piece of legislation if you haven't already and give us some feedback on where you see the alignment or possible alignment with the proposal or the strategy that is in the governor's approach. And I say, and I ask you to do that given the conference that's just taken place this weekend. I think it's still going on, the National Governors Conference, which is focused on high school education. I had the opportunity to catch some of that on C-SPAN, and frankly, Mr. Chair, I don't know how we carve out the time to do this, but it would be time well spent for our committee and all the education committees in the building to really take a look at the discussion that took place at that National Governor's Summit. We are so far below where we need to be as a nation that we really do not fully appreciate how our future is jeopardized, not just as a state, but as a nation. And we really need to work at gathering a greater sense of urgency around what it is we need to do to catch up to where we need to be. Without belaboring this, Mr. Nesbitt, I'm just asking you to take a look at that legislative proposal, Senate Bill 300. How does it help us?
or is there anything in there that would further fragment our efforts? You get the drift of what it is I'm asking you to
do. Would be happy to do that. I'd like to also share that effort with colleagues on the Higher Education Board who are working in other work groups on promoting that continuum between grade school, high school, and post-secondary community college and four-year institutions. And also, you'll be hearing more in our subsequent presentations from other work groups about the core curriculum between community colleges and our four-year institutions, where we've, I think, made a lot of progress in the last year. I think all of this ties together.
Yes.
And so I will try and tie it together by talking to my colleagues from those other work groups and give you a more comprehensive response at a later meeting.
I really appreciate it. And just by way of follow-up, if you could also communicate with Harvey Matthews at Associated Oregon Industries and Chuck Bennett with COSA. Those are the two folks that I've asked to help tie all this together and help us get to some consensus on a bill or a strategy.
Mr. Nesbitt and Mr. Kleiman, Ms. Merkel, we have about 4 minutes left now. Could you look for a point to close in the next 2 to 3 minutes? And I also apologize for having been pulled out to speak to the Senate President. But I want to assure you that I've read your presentation. In fact, you need to replace, I don't know how many of these books, but page 64 and 65 of the presentation did not reproduce very well, at least in my copy. It's one of the tables. So,
Senator, if I could take 1 minute to sum up my presentation, and then I'll turn it back to the others from OSAC. The recommendations you see from us for how to restructure and improve the Oregon Opportunity Grant at the $91.6 million recommended in the governor's budget, I'm pleased to say, has the support, the strong support of all of the groups who've been represented in developing this, and that's the Oregon Student Association, the community colleges, the private colleges, our own Board of Higher Education, and the philanthropic groups and others who participate in the work group. So we're very pleased we're able to bring you a united recommendation which addresses all of the sectors of our post-secondary education institutions.
The last slide, and I think this speaks to actually what's so good about the work that Tim's group did. This is not OSAC's grant, and it's not any one sector's grant. This is all of our grants, and this is the distribution by county that I thought you all would be interested in seeing. And that what I'm particularly excited about this biennium is that the governor has sort of raised the bar and put a spotlight on the question of access. And then the Access and Affordability Work Group basically picked up his call to say, what more do we need to do? And everything was done in really a very public process in a public fashion. And I think that's the thing really to be proud of. And what I'm really looking forward to for you all, I guess, is in phase two when you get to hear from some of the students. Because a lot of these paper students, it's not the same thing as hearing the real life story of folks. And so I'm really, I guess, looking forward to that part for you. I know that for myself, 15 years ago this month, I got my Opportunity Grant Award letter, and I was in Coos Bay, not sure I was going to be able to go to college. And when I got that letter, I had already been enrolled. That wasn't the point. It was, could I afford to go from a single-parent family with two kids? And when I got that letter, that was my ticket to a much better life. I'm a business owner in Salem, and we own an orchard in Hood River. I wouldn't be doing either of those things. I'd be still in Coos Bay hoping the Weyerhaeuser reopened a mill, which is not happening anytime soon, I can assure you. So when we can put some faces to these facts and figures, I think it's going to really help you understand the life-changing nature of the work we do at the Commission. And I think that's a good place for us to leave off for today.
Mr. Chairman? Yes. Senator Nelson.
I was sitting there. I wasn't going to say anything, but you talked about the Weyerhaeuser issue. And I was very interested in Tim's comments or his statistics, too, that basically our ability to fund public services has declined since the 1990s. I think that was basically your testimony. We're going down. There was a period of time in the late 1990s that it actually came up. And I've been an advocate saying that our ability to fund these public services has basically coincided with the decline in our timber industry. You're saying you couldn't get a job back now because of that. In another Natural Resource Committee subcommittee that I'm sitting on, basically the Forest Department says we could cut 1 billion board feet of lumber in the state on a sustainable basis to help fund education. I'm looking at around another state. Senator Gorley is recommending that we do a tax reform as answering our problem. How are we going to fund? How are we going to solve this problem? We need more money in the system. My idea is that I look around to other states. There are other states right now that have surpluses. Alaska is being that's the most extreme example. I mean, they don't have an income tax. They don't have a sales tax. They actually pay their citizens a dividend. And yet they have a $600 million surplus this year because of their oil. They figure out what their niche is. And they take our Montana is the same situation. They have a $300 million surplus. They only have an income tax. So Senator Gordon, I sometimes disagree because I'm saying it's not the taxing system. It's the fact that Oregon is failing to use its resources. And while you guys are coming in lobbying us and giving us information, I think we also have the obligation to send back information to you is that we need some help from the grassroots, from people saying, okay, we have to change how we're doing business here. If we want to fund these public services, if we want to provide these funds, how are we going to solve that problem? And so this is my lobbying effort at you folks to say, okay, what are some other solutions out there besides going to taxes? And I'd say go back to our natural resource base. It brought us to the dance. That's my comment.
Committee has pointed out to me also that the table on page 64 is repeated on page 76. And while it is very fuzzy on 64, it is clear on 76. So if you want to replace it, replace it.
All right.
There's one thing about this chart. It doesn't tell us how many folks didn't receive grants or opportunities in each of those counties. There's a broader picture, and I just keep challenging you to bring us that broader picture, which is also about need and opportunity unmet.
That's an excellent point, sir. I'm sure you could at least triple the numbers, considering our family of three who qualify is far below the average income in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, with that, we are adjourned till tomorrow morning. I will close the hearing on SB 5527 and adjourn till tomorrow morning at 8:30.
Yeah. See if I get